Tandem Nomads, Episode 7.
There's so much we don't talk about in expat communities. We don't talk about marital stress. We don't talk about relationship breakdown, divorce, struggling children, special needs children, children who need to see psychologists because they're not coping with relocating. We never talk about any of this stuff. It's not something that we should shout from the rooftop, but we need to get away from the stigma of those things, and we need to start addressing many more of those things, because then we have healthier expat communities.
Welcome to Tandem Nomads, where inspiring expat partners from around the world share with you how they turn the challenges of relocation into great opportunities. So are you following your partner abroad for his or her career? Do you feel the need to build your own source of accomplishment besides being a great partner and a great parent? Then Tandem Nomads is the place for you. Go to tandemnomads.com and sign up for the newsletter. Hello, Nomad Nation. This is Emel Deregi, and I'm very excited to bring to you today our featured guest, Yvonne McNulty. Yvonne?
Yes.
Are you ready for the ride?
Yes, I am.
Fantastic. Yvonne is an award-winning international business scholar specializing in expatriation and global mobility research. Raised in Australia, she's an experienced global citizen, having lived and worked in the US, in Singapore, and China. Her research has been featured in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, BBC, and many other international media. She published several books, and her next book, The Research Handbook of Expatriates, will be published in 2016. So this was a little short overview of who you are. What can you tell us to know you better, and tell us a bit about your story and what is happening in your world today?
Sure can. Thank you, Amal. I live in Singapore now, but I've previously lived in China, in Shanghai, and also in the United States. But I'm originally from Perth in Australia. I haven't lived in Australia for 16 years. So I've been an expat partner and the expat trailing partner for 16 years. I've been married for 17 years. So I have spent pretty much my entire married life as an expat wife. I have a husband who's a high-flying CEO. He works in software and technology. And I have two children, both of whom were born abroad. My daughters, one was born in the United States, and my second daughter was born in Singapore. And my daughters are only 16 months apart in age. Wow. So it was like raising twins. But we refer to ourselves as a mini United Nations family, because we are all born somewhere else in the world. And I'm obviously born in Australia, one daughter in the US, one daughter in Singapore, and my husband is born in Scotland, and he's Scottish. And we have two dogs as well. So, and both of the dogs were born in Melbourne in Australia. So we didn't start out planning to have this United Nations family. And I never, as a little girl, dreamed of wanting to live abroad and wanting to have a family that sort of lived this global life. It was never something that I planned or dreamt about. I never thought it was possible for me when I was growing up. This is something that really became a goal for my husband and I before we got married, and then became possible very soon, within 9 months after we were married, it became a reality, and we haven't looked back, and we haven't been back to Australia since we left. I don't know that this is accidental. We made a plan, we made it happen. There've been ups, there've been downs. It hasn't always been an easy ride. But on the personal side, that's where we are now. That's my family. That's who we are. That's where we came from.
That's beautiful. And I have a question, because you have quite an impressive bio. How do you manage to get such a busy work and busy lifestyle and manage both of them in relocation?
That's a great question. There's lots of infrastructure that I have in place to support that. That I don't have family around. I don't have my parents, my mum. I don't have my husband's family around. So we don't have the traditional inbuilt support systems that non-expats have, non-relocating people have. So I've had to buy a lot of the infrastructure, which means we have live-in domestic support here in Singapore, and in all the countries that we've lived in, we always paid for it. So we had a daycare, we had et cetera, et cetera. That helps to some extent. But the short answer to your question is, how do I do it all and make it happen? I try not to think about it too much. Mm. If I think about this is crazy or I'm overwhelmed, I don't get it done. So I tend not to dwell on it, and I tend to and the flip side of that is I tend not to dwell on it, and I tend not to do a lot of navel gazing about, you know, how is this all possible. At the same time, I don't run guilt trips on myself either. So whereas I may feel guilty that I'm paying for all this support or that I'm not here for some of the time with my children because I may be overseas at a conference, etc., I don't run the guilt trip, and I say, well, this is just part of the life that we built. This is part of the life that we wanted, and this is the kind of life that we wanted, and we make it happen the best way we can. And at the end of the day, my children and my relationship with my husband and my marriage, my family life, it doesn't suffer because I go away for a week to a conference. I keep things in perspective and try and do that more and more. So I guess I let myself off the hook. I've had to learn how to do that as I grew into motherhood and sort of expat motherhood, which is a little different to non-relocating motherhood. Yeah. So the other thing is I remind women all around me that I see, mums at the international school who are beating themselves up about whatever it might be. I remind them too and say, cut yourself some slack, get some perspective. So I tend to surround myself with a community of women who think like me and who feel the same as me, rather than a community of women who are going to guilt trip me. It's deliberate to do that. I tend to avoid negative women. I tend to avoid mums, not who are struggling. We've all got women in our community who are struggling, but I see my role in their life is to help them overcome the challenge just by sharing what worked for me, what didn't work for me, that kind of thing. But it's about moving towards positivity, right? It is a challenge to move there, but you can do it. So I hope that answers your question.
It does. Thank you. It does. When you decided to travel with your husband, move from Australia, was it a decision that was easy for you to make, or was there any hesitations concerning your life, your social network, your career?
None.
Risky for you?
No. I was 30 and I'm now 47. I was 30 when I made this decision, and I didn't know what a trailing spouse was. I'd never heard the term. I didn't know what it meant to be an expat wife. I didn't even really know what being an expatriate was. I just, in Australia, backpacking and going abroad in your gap year after university and this kind of thing, it's very common. And I figured that's what we were doing. My husband and I had not done that after we had graduated from university, and so this was our moment. Before we had children, to go and sort of travel the world, live abroad, that kind of thing. It was only, our first assignment was to Chicago, and we were localized in Chicago, which means that we didn't have any expat benefits. We basically got plane tickets, relocation of our household goods, and about 6 weeks temporary accommodation, and that was it, and visa assistance, and that was it. So we got to Chicago, and that first year and a half in Chicago was an eye-opener for me, and it was while we were there I realized the enormity of what I had agreed to and what I had pushed for, right?
Yeah.
And it was during that year and a half that I went through everything that trailing spouses go through, which is depression, anger, resentment, confusion, disappointment, a complete lack of purpose, a dramatic loss of self-esteem and confidence, and a real question mark over what now? What do I do with myself now? So in the first 3 months in Chicago, I loved it. You know, I'd worked full-time since I was 18 and I was now 30, and, you know, the opportunity to do nothing and to have this inbuilt excuse to do nothing was amazing. But, you know, 4th month, 6 month, 9 months into Chicago, it really, really wears thin after a while, and it's boring. Mm-hmm. And that's when I had my moment, and that's when I started researching and looking around for what is this phenomenon of what I'm experiencing, and that's when I discovered that there was this label for what I was, which was a trailing spouse. And so from that point of view, the risk assessment for me in terms of
of what I was facing, that came once I was already on assignment. And then I had to figure out whether I was going to stay on assignment, push to go back to Australia, or find some way to overcome it and continue with this expat life that we were living.
So you obviously found that way. And how did you do that?
Through study. I went back to university and I got a master's degree, and it focused on the trailing spouse. I wanted to understand more about it, and so I decided to make that the thesis topic for my master's. Actually, master's is what they call it in the United States. It was an honours degree in Australia, so it's the next degree that you do after you do an undergraduate degree. It's like the middle degree that you do. And that one was, I researched it, and that's when I discovered there was pretty much no decent research on the trailing spouse, and the phenomenon was not very well understood, and that most of the research that had been done on it had used samples of expat husbands to talk about their trailing spouse wife's experiences. And I found that was a big gap, and what we really needed to do was hear from the community themselves. And so that's what I did. So I started that research.
When was that actually? Which year?
2002.
Yeah, because when I started Tandem Nomads, I had the same issue. You know, I started looking for research. Actually, before even I started Tandem Nomads, I started questioning how do people do it around the world. And I realized that until now, there are few research, and I'm happy there are people like you today that are taking care of it. But still, I found that it's very little, actually. Who's going to pay for those studies and researchers? And apparently there's more and more companies who are interested in it. You can maybe tell me more about it, but what do you think about this? Do you find today there is any directions that companies should take in this field?
Well, I would say yes, somebody needs to pay for it. I think though that the bigger issue I have found myself, the bigger issue is access to the people that you want to study. So getting it, the quality of a sample and who you study is, you know, it's very important. It's critical to get good research, to get good data, and from that to be able to, you know, develop and build and improve policy and implications for organizations. So while paying for research is one thing, it's getting the right sample and then getting access to that sample. And I think that that is challenging for a lot of researchers, is to access the sample and to get the buy-in from a particular community to want to talk to you as the researcher and open up. There's so much we don't talk about in expat communities. We don't talk about marital stress. We don't talk about relationship breakdown, divorce, struggling children, special needs children, children who need to see psychologists because they're not coping with relocating. We never talk about any of this stuff. It's all hush hush, and it's not something that we should shout from the rooftop, but we need to sort of get away from the stigma of those things, and we need to start addressing many more of those things, because then we have healthier expat communities.
Yeah.
And that's something that I'm trying to do with my research, is to research and publish, you know, expat single parents, LGBT expat families, split family arrangements where you've got, you know, commuting going on, and lesbian expatriates and gay expatriates, and families that adopt children while they're overseas, families with special needs children, multi-generational families where parents relocate. There's all sorts of family types that we know absolutely nothing about, and amazingly they exist in the expat community, and I can find them and I can interview them, and yet most of us wouldn't even know that they even existed.
Yeah.
And yet they do. They just, you know, we don't talk about these things. So I think that's looking at it for what things are. In Singapore, I'm connected to a male trailing spouse groups. I'm connected to three of them. And I have run focus groups with them to study their issues and trials, and also to study their wives, who are the breadwinners in the family. And that's an issue of access. That's not an issue of money to pay for research. That's having enough credibility to say to these groups, we need to know more about what your trials are, and also your triumphs and your success factors. So
Very interesting. So you think that male trading spouses are more reluctant to participate to such research? Or
Yes, definitely. Yes. Yeah. The ones that I've encountered have been very open about it, but it took a lot of rapport and relationship building in order to get them to feel comfortable enough to open up about what that is, because they're already judged in expat communities for being unusual or unique. And so the last thing they want to do is be judged again by a researcher. So it can be tricky. It's partly data and it's partly numbers when you do research, but it's also about human beings and relationships and being sensitive to their issues and rapport building and relationship building. And there are two sides to the qualitative researcher, mm-hmm. and bringing those together takes skill and time and experience to do that, which is what I hope I've built up over the last 15 years.
We'll go back and forth to your experience as a researcher in this topic. If you're in a networking party, you know that famous question that we were asked, what do you do?
I say I'm an adjunct professor at RMIT University in Singapore, and I'm principal consultant at Expat Research, a consultancy that I run that does research on expatriates.
What are your revenue streams? How do you earn your income?
I earn most of my income from my adjunct teaching, so at university. So my bread and butter is being an academic, teaching and lecturing to university students. And I have a number of positions at three different universities, and I can choose when I teach and the courses that I teach based on what's going on in my research life and how busy I am, the demands of a project that may be coming up. So I can pick and choose the lecturing according to that. So that would be my bread and butter income. Mm-hmm. My second stream of income is expat research and the research that I do. I don't make any money at all. I do not earn an income from the research itself. Mm-hmm. That is purely part of my academic career. Where the revenue comes in is drafting white papers for consulting firms about my research, and then they will use those white papers. They'll brand it as, you know, for example, Santa Fe Group or Brookfield, and they will. But I am the author.
Interesting. It's good to know that. Yeah, because I always question, you know, who's ordering those researchers. Actually, it's your idea to start the research on the topic, and then you talk to consulting companies to promote your research, and then write the white papers for them.
Exactly, and then they will provide case study participants for me to interview as part of the topic that we've agreed on for a particular white paper, if it's necessary. Sometimes I have those contacts and case studies myself from my own network and my own research. So that's a secondary stream of income. I also present at conferences, and that has conference fees associated with it. I do webinars, that has fees associated with it. So there's a variety of things, but it is all focused around the research that I'm doing. So if somebody comes to me, if a consulting firm comes to me and asks me to do a white paper or a webinar or a conference presentation on a topic that is not related to what I do, I turn it down. I'm not about relearning or having to learn something entirely new in order to present. I'm very clear about the lane that I'm in, the niche market that I serve and the core expertise that I have, and I stay in that lane because that's where I feel I add most value.
That's a great advice. This is something that I would like to stress with the Nomad Nation, is that Yvonne has just explained how she stick to her niche. And this is one of the major, I think, advice when we want to start a business or even career. I think it's very important to stick to your niche and your major value.
Yes.
It's what makes it sustainable and where you can improve and become successful.
Well, if we go back to your earlier question about how do I do it all, mm-hmm. how do I do kids, and my husband travels on business 30, 40, 50% of the time, so I'm single parenting. So how do I manage and juggle it all? I had to learn. Don't get me wrong, I wasn't always like this. In the early days, I made a lot of mistakes because I said yes to a lot. Because when you're the partner, when you're the trailing partner, there can be an element of desperation mm-hmm. to wanting to find your purpose and wanting to add value and wanting to raise your self-esteem and confidence. And what happens is that you say yes to a lot because you're not really sure. Everything looks like an opportunity and you're not sure what is an opportunity and what isn't. Over the years, especially as my daughters got older and they needed less of me physically but more of me emotionally, it became about, it wasn't just about me being physically present in their lives. I also had to be emotionally present, and that takes a lot of time and energy. And if my work was sucking me dry, I didn't have the good quality emotional time to invest with them. So I really had to do – I worked with a coach about 3 years ago. I really had to sit down and work out why was I feeling so overwhelmed and why was I feeling pulled in a million directions. And it was basically because I was saying yes to opportunities that were not really opportunities. They were opportunities to the people that were presenting it to me. But when I really looked at what they were asking or requesting, it really wasn't an opportunity for me. So my job became to really determine, is this really an opportunity for me or not? Who benefits most from this? And it changed at that moment. It was like, it was an epiphany. It changed everything about how I did this life, career, mum, expat, you know, the lot. It changed everything. It almost instantaneously in a moment, I got it and thought, okay. And the change was phenomenal. In a month, my entire model in terms of how I did this completely changed. And I haven't looked back. I can never go back to the way I used to do it.
Thank you so much for sharing this. This is really a huge takeaway. You know, it's really one of the major advice I think we should remember, all of us as expat partners. And in general in life, you know, it's first focus and don't get dispersed. Focus on your niche and on your core skill in order to be able to give the best qualities and best services.
Exactly.
Yeah. Let's go back to your partnership and to your tandem. How do you organize yourselves as a tandem, your relationship with your partner, but also your kids? It's a tandem of four, right? Exactly. In transition, how do you organize yourselves? How do you support each other in the move when you move from a country to another?
Well, I have to say, this is so timely that you're talking to me today. There's no moves planned for us, thank goodness. I am not the nicest person when we move a house down the road, across the street, or across the world. I'm not the nicest person. I love being an expat, but I hate moving. And it's a real contradiction. But I don't think I'm unique. I think there's many people who feel that way. How do we work together? I think I got used to, in the early days of our moves, we've done over 16 years, my husband and I together have done 9 house moves as expatriates. Six of those were international moves, and 3 of those were internal moves domestically within a particular city that we were living in. So it's been 9 different houses that we've had since we've been expats. But we also did 4 before we became expats since we met each other. And then my first career was in the Royal Australian Navy. So I was a military girl for 5 years, and I did 7 moves with the military. So since the age of 18, what are we getting up to? We're getting up to nearly 20 moves. It's crazy.
Crazy.
In the beginning, I took on everything myself. I was this, you know, uber wife and mum who just, you know, said, I got this, I can do it. And it would take me a year to recover after every move because it's just so enormous. What I've learnt is that the tandem part that you're talking about is to truly delegate and dish things out. And in the last move that we did, I delegated the whole lot to my husband and said, you're in charge, you tell me what you want me to do, instead of me being in charge and me telling you what you want, you know, I need you to do. I flipped it around and just said, I was really honest. And I think that's one of the things that you need to be with family members, is to be absolutely honest.
Yeah.
And we tend to hold it together. We tend to put on a brave face. For some of us, we don't have a choice. Our husbands are unavailable to help with moves. We have to do it. If you don't have a career or something outside the home or something that's yours, if you haven't carved out something that is your own in terms of outside employment or outside work, then unfortunately a move is going to fall all on your shoulders, because in the family, you're the most obvious person to do the move. Exactly. And so it's going to fall on your shoulders. I've always maintained an outside career, a purpose or something, so that that didn't happen to me. And it's worked well. I've been able to say, oh, I can't do 100% of this. And I've been honest with my kids and with my husband. And in our family, it used to be a bit of a blame game, you know, why don't you like change, mummy? My daughter's never said that to me, but my husband would say, you know, change is a good thing, you need to embrace it. And I kind of would say, yeah, change is a good thing, but it's not for everybody. And I like change, but I like long-term change. I like to be in places for 6 or 7 years and then move, whereas my husband could move every 2 or 3 years.
Wow. So did he support, how was the delegation part?
Good.
Yeah, it worked out.
In the last one, yeah, the ninth move, it worked out brilliantly. And he did. He took charge. He arranged everything and then just said, okay, I need you to do change of address. I need you to do this. I need you to do that. And now with the children moving, it's easy. I say to them, right, you're in charge of your room. You go and unpack your boxes. You go pack up your boxes. I do my room. He does. My husband has his study. I have a study. We have our master bedroom. We divvy it up and we delegate.
That's great. Yeah.
And tell them that, you know, a big saying in our house is that if you want the reward, then you have to put in the effort. You know, you've got to. Everybody loves the idea of being in the new location. Well, we don't get there flying on a broomstick. You know, it's all got to. Everybody's got to do their bit to get there. So, you know, I can't lie to you and say that moving is some Disneyland affair in our house, because it's not. It's stressful. Everybody hates it. Everybody's biting everybody's head off. But we recognize the moment, and then we're kind to ourselves. We go and do things that kind of calm us down. And my husband gives me time off to just go and recharge and, you know, because I'm the person in the family. It's unbelievable, isn't it? I'm an expat researcher, and I have to tell you that my bugbear in life is I hate moving.
This is fantastic.
I'll say that to you, and I'll say that to your entire audience.
Yeah.
I'm an expat, and I love what
I'm
do.
I'm so happy that you just admit it, you know, and it's important to just admit it. We can't do everything we want in life, and there are things that we don't like, and we just have to go through it. And in a way, we just have also to manage a way to make it easier, and you did by learning how to delegate.
And I always say to mums here, because I see them when they – I've been in Singapore now for 10 years with a very short 18 months in between – where we went to China and we were in Shanghai. And I see the international school mums when they've just gotten off what I call just gotten off the boat, and they've just arrived, and they're looking frazzled, and, you know, they're taking on everything and they're doing everything and they're going into overdrive. And I when they're falling in a heap in front of me, crying their eyes out and saying, this is nonsense, I hate this, you know, I'm et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I grab them by the shoulders and I say, nobody is going to give you a gold medal at Changi Airport when you arrive or when you leave, saying, you know, bravo for you, you did it all by yourself and you made it. I mean, there is no prize for being, you know, the best moving expat mum in the world, whatever it is, there isn't.
That's for sure not.
There's none. And it's the most thankless job in the world. And I think we've got to let ourselves off the hook. Moving is moving. It's about getting from A to B, and that's it.
Yeah.
Two tips for how you do that. The first is that I didn't do it in the first two moves, but then the subsequent seven I did. I would move to a location, and I would put a date on the calendar and I would circle it and say, by this date, moving will be done. Wow. Which means, like you, the 3 weeks, when you've got children, sometimes it can take 6 weeks, sometimes it can take 2 months, 3 months. But I had a date. So if we moved in August, I would say, right, by 1st of October, that's it. My ability and availability to run errands and source this and find that and get handyman and put up pictures and, you know, it just goes on and on and on. All that stuff that you do when you set up a house, by the 1st of October, it's done and I am no longer available to do it.
Very
the
good.
Second thing is that we would have, when we were We're localized here, and we are medium term settled. So we've bought an apartment. We have moved in, and we have a 10-year plan now. We're no more moving until the children are off at university, and that's a very unusual decision for expats to make, but it's the decision that we've made based largely on me, because I pushed for it and said, I can't handle this much change anymore. I have career aspirations and we need to just be in one place for a while. And because we're localized, we can do that. Mm-hmm. When we were moving and we were going to all these different places, no room in my house ever changed. So the children's bedroom, the pictures on their wall, the furniture that they had, the duvet covers, the lot, it was basically pack up the room and put the room back together in the new location, give or take a bookcase or whatever it was that didn't fit in the new room. But essentially the walls changed, but the furnishing stayed the same. And it had the effect of I didn't then have to go out in every new location and buy a whole bunch of new stuff to furnish every room. But also, especially with the kids, it made them feel very comforted because – it looked exactly the same as what they had in the last location.
That's great.
Even though everything else had changed, but that looked the same. You walk into the bedroom and the bedroom looked exactly the same as what they had in the US or wherever it was.
Yeah.
So the third thing I always do is the pictures have to go up on the wall within 2 weeks of arriving, because nothing makes a place feel like a home until you get pictures on the wall and then it looks like your place again. No, so you get a handyman in and you just pay him his whatever fee he's got and you just make a decision and you just put it on the wall and get them off the floor, right? Unpack. All the packing boxes have got to be gone within 2 weeks of arriving. Everything, even if I've got nowhere to put it, it's got to be out of the box, on the floor, and the packing box and tape and material and all that kind of stuff, which actually makes me feel completely nauseous whenever I see it now, it's got to be out of the house and it's got to be gone so that we have arrived. So those are sort of psychological things that
are thank you. Those are great three tips. It was really, really great. Practical and straight to the point. You know, you mentioned at the beginning when we started how you felt in your first months in Chicago in your first year. Could you take us to that moment you considered as your toughest experience?
I've had a difficult moment then, and I had another difficult moment in 2012 when we were in China. Really interesting, because it was 12 years after I'd first become an expat, and that was another epiphany for me. Another pivotal moment was in China when I was the so-called seasoned expatriate. In Chicago, my moment of reckoning was when we arrived. My husband and I arrived in Chicago on a Thursday, and the following Monday morning, he started traveling for his work, and neither of us were really aware that that was what his job involved. And it stayed like that for a year and a half. He would go on a Monday morning and come back on a Thursday night or a Friday night. We had no children and I knew no one. So I was literally thrown in on the deep end. I loved my newfound freedom and independence for the first 3 months. But after that, the sort of day of reckoning for me was when I realized that I had allowed this. I had said yes. And as resentful as I felt towards his company, towards him for abandoning me, towards this situation I found myself in, I had to own up to the fact that I had said yes. I had willingly gone. I had done no research, none, about what I was getting myself into. And I had made a whole bunch of assumptions. So as angry as I was, and I was angry, and as resentful I was, and I was asked my husband, I was hugely resentful. I couldn't pin it all on him.
Yeah.
I couldn't pin it all on his company. I had to take responsibility for that. And that was a very intense period of personal growth and development, was to look at myself and say, well, what role did I have in this? So I had to say, I had to make a decision whether I was going to continue to play the victim and say, this is happening to me and this is unfair, or whether I could swallow that and say, well, I had a role in this and what am I going to do about it now? So that's when I decided to embark on the honours degree, and then that immediately the response to my trailing spouse research was enormous, very, very positive, and that immediately led into a PhD. And so then I started a PhD, and that's when I began researching expatriate return on investment, which is a very company-focused side of mobility.
That's amazing. I love what you just shared, the story you shared, because it's exactly my motto for Tandem Nomads when I say, let's turn the challenges into opportunities. And this is exactly what you've done. You took your problem between your hands and just found a way to turn it around. You shared with me one of your research that's called Being Dumped into the Sink or Swim. It's an empirical study of organizational support for the trading spouse.
Absolutely.
Could you summarize it?
It looked at social, professional, and practical support, organizational support for the trailing spouse, and how well companies did in providing that to them. The study found that companies do a pretty good job on providing practical support for the trailing spouse. These are things like the relocation itself, immigration services, etc., settling in. It did a so-so or relatively poor job on professional support for helping a trailing spouse find employment and re-establish their career or a new career in another location. It tracked at about 30%, and it did a pretty shocking job on organizations provided virtually no support for social support for connecting them to other expats, to helping them adjust. Social support is linked to adjustment. So what the study found was certain pinch points that are important in the trailing spouse experience, which is the dual career issue and marital stress, are two big ones. Mm-hmm. And they both combine to impact on a trailing spouse's identity, mm-hmm. and how well a trailing spouse is able to reestablish an identity in a new location. Because ultimately, no matter what you do, whether you go to a new location as a trailing spouse and you continue to be a stay-at-home mum and you're heavily involved in, say, volunteer work or the international school where your children go, that is part of reestablishing that identity that you've chosen. Or whether you are someone who wants to go back into paid employment and work outside the home or continue a home business or, you know, work from home, doing what you might do, it's all about reestablishing an identity. Mm-hmm. And companies
that was the biggest, basically, the conclusion of the research is that at the end of the day, what you found out is that most of expat partners do face with a huge loss of identity. And I've seen somewhere that it was written, correct me if it's wrong, but one of your research found out that only 10 to 15% of these expat partners find a way to fix this issue.
That's right.
That's huge.
And It is. When you compare it to the number who had a fuller identity before relocating to the new location, so they could have had a fuller identity in the last location, mm-hmm. expat location, or in their home country, that number of spouses who felt that they were working or they had that identity was quite high, and then it drops down to 10 to 15%. And I have to say, one of the biggest findings from this study is that we can't pin it all on organizations. Yep. It is too easy to say it's the organization's responsibility to build me a new life. It's not. The organization can only facilitate some things to help you get there. It boils down to, honestly, as a trailing spouse, it is up to you. It is your determination, your savviness, your commitment, your tenacity to rebuild your life. No one, including the organization, is twisting your arm and saying that you have to go on an assignment. Yep. Even if, you know, this gets into marriage dynamics, there are some marriages where women don't have a say and the husbands do come home and say, we're moving, start packing. Some industries, you know, expect mobility, and if you're not prepared to be mobile, you don't have a job anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, there are, I get that. In corporate, that's less so. Corporate moves predominantly allow for an expat, to say yes or say no to a move. And, you know, it's a complicated issue. It can be complex. There are multiple layers. But that's really the major findings. And that 10 to 15% of spouses who do find new work or reestablish their identity, a lot of that comes down to their own tenacity and their own determination to do it, mm-hmm. in spite of the fact that they're not getting a lot of support from organizations to assist them.
Fantastic. Yeah, this is really interesting research. I hope it's okay if we share it with the Nomad Nation on the post of this episode.
No problem at all.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you. So I will, Nomad Nation, I will put this research on the page that related to this episode, and you will be able to read through it. It's really interesting, all the findings of this research. Are you planning on other type of research in this area?
I am. I'm doing research at the moment on the male channeling spouse, as I mentioned. I am also doing research on global families and looking at their success factors. These are families that continuously move and what makes them successful. And, you know, we know them. We've met them. Families that seem to thrive on mobility and others that don't. So what is the sort of success factors for that? I'm looking at other things on the family side. I'm obviously looking at when things go wrong, expat divorce. I'm starting a study next year on the Hague Convention. These are Hague cases of international child abduction. So that one's coming up next year. And an ongoing study on dual career issues for trailing spouses and their families. And I would like to start, I think it'll be 2017 before I can start this one, but I'm going to start a study on expat children as well.
Interesting. I was going to ask you to start our spinning round with the first question. What is your plans for the coming 2 years? But it seems like you've got some big plans right now.
Yes, I do. Yes, and got it worked out.
So let's get back to the spinning round. Do you have an internet research like Skype that you find useful in your nomadic life?
Oh, Facebook.
Facebook. Wow. Mm-hmm. Why is it so useful?
I belong to a number of groups. I find it immediate. The speed is great. The groups are focused. Personal messaging is fantastic. I've never thought I'd say that, but for me, Facebook.
Fantastic. Which book would you recommend to tandem nomads?
Oh, gosh. Oh, that's a tough question because I have a bookshelf full. Okay. I would recommend Essentialism, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less by Greg McKeown. I would also recommend, there's a book here called The Bitch in Your Head, How to Finally Squash Your Inner Critic by Jacqueline Horner Plumez. I've actually heard her speak. She's a New York-based author.
What is the best way to reach you and know more about you?
I have a website, Expat Research. There's a contact page on there. You can contact me via that anytime. I have an email address. It's ymcnulty@expatresearch.com. You can also Facebook me. You can LinkedIn me. There are many ways to find me. I'm not hard to find at all.
I was saying how much I think that the work you're doing is really valuable to our community. I'm sure that our community will be very happy to participate to your surveys. If you were mentioning how hard it was for you to find people who would accept to participate. So if anybody in Tandem Nomads would like to help you and participate to one of your surveys, what should they do?
They can go to the website expatresearch.com. On the website, there is a studies page. It is the very first flag at the top of the page. Click on that and it will take you to, there are, well, let me see, 22 studies that are of which about 9 are live at the moment. And you can go onto those. It will take you to a study page where it will explain what the objectives of the study are, who should participate, what it will involve, and how long it will take to participate. Click on that, and then away you go. I would welcome the involvement of everybody because the data and the studies are only as good as the expats that are willing to have a voice and share their experiences.
Exactly. So Nomad Nation, don't hesitate. Go to expatresearch.com and then click on study and share your experience with Yvonne. Don't hesitate.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Yvonne. This was really great. You've shared so many value bombs in here. So thank you for participating to this episode and sharing your experience as an expat partner, but also as a researcher specialized in expatriation.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
Nomad Nation, don't miss any of the great inspiration, tips, and insights that we'll prepare just for you. Go to tandemnomads.com and sign up for the newsletter.